Well, as we meet here today on the Sabbath during the Feast of Tabernacles, it's an appropriate time to consider the benefits and importance of God's Sabbath, and also how it relates to the Feast of Tabernacles that we're here celebrating. The title of my sermon is God's Sabbath, Past, Present, and Future. We'll begin with a brief overview of the Sabbath. I'm going to go kind of quickly. This should be very familiar territory to us, but just kind of a survey from the beginning when the Sabbath was created and move on forward, and then tie it in with how it applies to the Feast of Tabernacles and the meanings that it has in common with those particular occasions as well. Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 and 3 is where the Sabbath was first established. So we have the creation record. The first chapter, of course, of Genesis is talking about the creation, recreation, whatever term you wish to use there. And then in chapter 2 of Genesis, beginning verse 1, it says, "Thus the heavens and earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work, which God had created and made." Then moving forward to the time of the nation of Israel, very fast forward here, one of the Ten Commandments, as we know, listed in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, has to do with the Sabbath. We'll read the one in Exodus first of all. Exodus chapter 20, I'm going to read this in a New Living Translation, reading verses 9 through 11 of that chapter. The Ten Commandments are listed there. I like the way the New Living is worded in this and many other places, but verse 9 in particular says, "You have 6 days each week for your ordinary work." Because some people think it means you're commanded to work 6 days. So if you only work 5 days a week, you're a slacker or something. And if you're retired, woe be to you, you know. But it's really saying, you know, you got 6 days to get your work done. Because it's just like when the manna was given, you know, you can get all the manna that you need in the 6 days, and you do something different on the Sabbath. And that's the thought here. "You have 6 days each week for your ordinary work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath day of rest dedicated to the Lord your God. On that day, no one in your household may do any work. This includes you, your sons, your daughters, your male and female servants, your livestock, and any foreigners living among you." And the reason it's given here in this version of the Ten Commandments, it says, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and everything in them. But on the seventh day he rested. That's why the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and set it apart as holy." As a reminder of that historic event of creation and looking back to God as the creator. In Deuteronomy's account, Deuteronomy chapter 5, we'll read verses 12 through 15. Deuteronomy chapter 5, again, I'll read that in the New Living Translation. A little bit different wording here, and part of it, most of it pretty much the same, but a little bit different reason and is given here as well for keeping the Sabbath. Verse 12, "Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. You have 6 days each week for your ordinary work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath day of rest dedicated to the Lord your God." And he says in verse 15, which is not included in the Exodus account, "Remember that you were once slaves in Egypt, but the Lord your God brought you out with his strong hand and powerful arm. That's why the Lord your God has commanded you to rest on the Sabbath day." And I think maybe there's an inference in there as well, implication rather, I should say, that don't say, well, I got to keep the Sabbath, so I'll just have all my slaves do my work so I can enjoy the Sabbath. I think he's saying, you know what, remember, you were slaves in Egypt. You didn't have the opportunity to keep the Sabbath. And now that you do have that opportunity, you make sure that you give your slaves an opportunity to observe the Sabbath as well. So, you know, people tend to do that. Let somebody else do my dirty work so I can go out and have a great time. You know, it's slavery is not a real bad thing if it's done right. I mean, the scriptures in the Old Testament talk about how to treat your slaves. In fact, even the New Testament as well. So I'm not advocating slavery, but I don't even mean to go there. But anyway, the point is that the Sabbath was something to be enjoyed by everybody there in the household, not just the head of the household. Exodus 31, we'll move over there next. We'll go back to the New King James. Exodus chapter 31. Something very important about the Sabbath and how important it was to the nation of Israel. I could have also covered in Exodus 16, there, you know, about when the manna was given. That was done. I can't cover everything and get to the main part of the sermon, but the purpose for giving the manna was to teach the Israelites about the Sabbath, to remember the Sabbath. You know, it's a hands-on learning thing. You go out and get the manna, you know, 6 days. You go out in the seventh day, it's not going to be there. So don't even bother to go out of your house because there's going to be no manna there. And there are some people there from Missouri. Show me. If we're out of their house, sure enough, no manna there. And God says, how long are these people going to disobey me? So, you know, some didn't get the point. That's 747 going over the head again, right? To this day, that's an element of human nature, unfortunately. Anyway, in Exodus 31, verse 12, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it's a sign between me and you throughout your generations, so that you may know that I'm the Lord who sanctifies you. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it's holy to you. We're going to summarize these down to about three different reasons for the Sabbath here pretty quickly. Verse 16, he says, therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. Again, he says, it's a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And one of the methods God uses in teaching is repetition. So one more time, we can go now to Ezekiel chapter 20. And we'll see those same points listed here once again. Ezekiel chapter 20. I'm going to read verse 20 here first of all, and then back up to verse 12. The whole chapter is important as well. I'll mention that later, but not really get into it. But for right now, we'll just consider these two verses, Ezekiel 20 and verse 20, which says, hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God, which we just read earlier in Exodus. Verse 12 says, I also gave them my Sabbaths to serve as a sign between me and them, so they will know that I'm the Lord who set them apart as holy. All right, so what have we seen here? God gave Old Testament Israel the Sabbath as an identifying sign. Number one, to identify to the Israelites God as the creator. Okay, it was for their benefit to remember who God is. He's the God who created the heavens and the earth, to identify God as the creator to the Israelites. Secondly, it was to remind them that God set them apart to be holy, that they were a special people. Not because they were bigger. In fact, there's scripture that says that. Not because they're bigger, because in fact they weren't. They're very small. Same is true with God's people down through the ages. It's always been a small group. And we're not any better than anybody else. I think that's something we all had to learn when we first started out. Probably a lot of us were, head got a little bit big. Well, I understand something you don't understand. Why are you so dumb? Why can't you understand this? We never asked, why was I so dumb before God, you know, entered my life? But it's a small, very small group. But God is the one who set them apart to be holy. Very important to realize that. I think sometimes, you know, when we've known each other for decades, you know, the hands go up, you've been here 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. By the way, this is my 50th year, too, so I didn't raise my, I forgot about that. I always say about birthdays, in a happy and birthday, you don't go together anymore after a certain period of time, you know. I'm not so sure about hate to think of what the ramifications. But anyway, get on track here. So God sets us apart to be holy. And my point I was going to make is that I think sometimes maybe we forget that because we don't have halos over our heads. You know, that's what people tend to think about holy. But we're God's holy people. We're special people. And, you know, the old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. Sometimes you kind of take for granted the good things, and human nature tends to gravitate toward the negative things. It's a tendency we need to overcome. Because we have an awful lot to be thankful for as part of God's people. And as Mr. Luker says continually, we realize that we're not the only ones of God's people. That would be very arrogant to say that, and we don't believe that. Only God knows who his people are, and our main concern is make sure that we're one of them. But it's a special privilege. And I think sometimes we get to know each other so well, it's just kind of like bang on the arm. You know, when I was a kid, we used to hit each other in the arm and stuff. And familiarity is okay, but let's just never forget that we're also special in God's sight. Because we can kind of take that for granted if we're not careful. Isaiah chapter 58, verse 13. The Sabbath is given there to help us to realize that there's something special about God's calling. There's something special about what God is doing in us and through us and for us. I'm going to read this again from the New Living Translation. Isaiah 58 and verses, I'm going to read verses 13 and 14. Keep the Sabbath day holy. Don't pursue your own interests on that day, but enjoy the Sabbath and speak of it with delight as the Lord's holy day. You know, a few years ago, there was a young couple I met that grew up in church, and they weren't attending anymore, but they were still keeping a Sabbath. And they had their little kids with them, and their little boy said, "I love the Sabbath." And I thought, wow, those parents are doing something right. I imagine a lot of us who grew up in the church, I didn't, but a lot of you, I should say, because I didn't, but maybe you didn't have that pleasant of a remembrance. But I would guess this, that probably everybody in here, if I asked you what things that you remember most about growing up in church, probably there'd be three things I would say. Feast of Tabernacles, summer camp, and Friday night dinners, right? The Sabbath. And that's the way it should be. It's a blessing. It should be a blessing. It shouldn't be some burden where you can't do this and you shouldn't do that. It should be a blessing. You speak of it, as it says here, with delight as the Lord's holy day. Special day is what it means. Honor the Sabbath in everything you do on that day, and don't follow your own desires or talk idly. Then the Lord will be your delight, and I will give you great honor and satisfy you with the inheritance I promised your ancestor Jacob. I, the Lord, have spoken. So it's like, okay, this is right from the top here. The third reason God gave Old Testament Israel the Sabbath as an identifying sign is to identify them as his people. First point was to identify God as the creator to the Israelites. This one is to identify them as his people. It was like a sign that says, I'm one of God's people. To this day, the identity of the Jews remains, whereas the identity of the rest of Israel has been lost to history, so-called lost 10 tribes. I think one major reason for that is because the Israelites basically lost the Sabbath. They lost that sign, and so nobody knows who they are because that sign isn't there anymore. There's a common saying in Judaism today that it is said that more than Israel has kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept Israel. I think that's good, you know. Not just that the Israelites have kept Shabbat, but Shabbat has kept Israel. To this day, everybody knows who the Jews are. They're still keeping a Sabbath. I don't think that's a coincidence. It's an identifying sign. Well, sadly, and getting back to Ezekiel 20 again, I'm not going to go there, but this whole chapter documents the fact that the two major reasons that the nation of Israel was taken into captivity were Sabbath breaking and idolatry. Those two were singled out of all the other commandments as the main things that God took exception to. Well, you know, true to human nature, the Israelites who returned from captivity decided, boy, we're never going to let that happen again. So they simply went to the opposite extreme. You know, that's the way human nature is. If this is wrong, then this is right. No, a lot of times, this is right. Center of the road. Of course, the problem with that is, I mean, we all agree with that, I suppose, but we tend to identify the center of the road as wherever we stand. So I'm standing over here. That's the center of the road. Standing over there, that's the center of the road. Which is, you know, every man's way is right in his own eyes, the Bible says. But anyway, so they really went to the opposite extreme is basically what happened. And they came up with a number of what they called fence laws. You understand what fence laws mean? Down in the Pine State Park, close to where we live, there's a big tree down there. You know, Jack Scruggs, my friend Jack Scruggs, used to laugh about that. Boy, that tells what it is. It's a big tree. It's what it is, all right. Well, it's like 500 years old. So it's the oldest tree known in the state of Oregon. You know what? They got a fence around it. You know why? To keep people out so they don't damage the tree. So what some of the Israelites decided to do to protect the Sabbath, they built what they called fence laws. Okay, well, if you're going to keep the Sabbath, you've got to do this, 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 and this. And before you know it, the fence laws became more important than the Sabbath. And furthermore, they were in many ways contrary to the Sabbath and what God had in mind with regard to the Sabbath. But that's, again, what happens with human nature. They went to that opposite extreme. Matthew 23 and verse 4, you can see what Jesus said about those laws, many of those laws, those fence laws. Matthew 23, verse 4. So we're kind of moving ahead now to the New Testament, what it talks about regarding the Sabbath. And again, you could read the whole chapter. I mean, the whole chapter of Matthew 23 is just documenting all these abuses, all the burdens that the scribes and Pharisees in particular had imposed on the people. We'll just summarize it here with verse 4, which says, "They bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers." I think the New Living helps us understand that last part of that verse. It says, "They crush people with impossible religious demands and never lift a finger to ease the burden." I think that captures the meaning very, very well. So, of course, there are a lot of different restrictions, and some of them are kind of humorous in a way, really, when you think about it. One of them, for example, is if, and this didn't relate to the Sabbath, it related to idolatry. One of the fence laws to make sure you don't commit idolatry, and this is true, and it's not a joke now, this is really true. If someone were to accidentally drop a coin in front of an idol, you know, which to some nationalities is a bigger problem than others, right? Guess what they had to do? Jewish rule, and you can look this up, prohibits bending over to pick it up. Gives the appearance of bowing down to an idol. So they literally said you had to sit down in your rear end, pick it up, and then stand up. Kind of funny, isn't it? You know, Orthodox Judaism, my understanding is, and I hope this is correct, but if you go to Jerusalem today and you go to that particular area, all the toilet tissue is torn off, so you don't have to do that on the Sabbath. I mean, you know, come on. But that's human nature. It goes to extremes. So what Jesus did in the New Testament is he upheld the noble purpose of the Sabbath and sought to set it free from the binding restrictions of Jewish traditions that defeated the whole purpose of the Sabbath. Sabbath is supposed to be a delight, not some day that you got to whip out your Talmud and say, what can I do, what can't I do? You know, that's not what the Sabbath is ever meant to be. So he said in Matthew 11, verses 28 through 30, a very famous statement that is often misunderstood, misapplied, misused. So hang in there. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell you what it really means, what we all know it means. He said in verse 28, beginning, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And there are people say, well, see, we don't have to keep the Sabbath anymore. Jesus kept it for us and he's our Sabbath. Why would you want to take away the Sabbath? The Sabbath is a delight. So you can work an extra day. Well, you might make more money, but, you know, God made us to need rest on a regular basis. That wasn't what he's talking about here. One of the things he was doing is simply offering a better option than the legalistic approach of Jewish tradition. That's obvious in the context. He's merely saying, you know, I'm going to free you from all these obligations. Do you ever see that picture of the Lilliputian giant, I think it's called? This big old giant, he's tied down, all these little men around him, and he's got him all tied up and strapped down there with pegs. How many of you have seen that picture? A lot of you have. I guess if I'd have been thinking about it, I could have brought it. But that's what they did with the Sabbath. They tied people down. The Sabbath ceased to be a delight. Because all these picky rules and regulations that were intended, you know, to protect the Sabbath, when in effect, it actually defeated the whole purpose of the Sabbath. Mark 2, verses 27 and 28. Jesus sets the record straight here as well. Another very classic statement that you don't hear quoted an awful lot by people that don't believe in the Sabbath, because it's pretty clear what Jesus' position was on the Sabbath in this statement. It wasn't against the Sabbath. I guess some people at the time accused him of breaking the Sabbath because he broke the fence laws. But in fact, I have an article that was in the first issue of the Good News. Which commandments did Jesus break? Was the title of the article. He did break commandments, you know. Commandments of men that violated God's laws, the commandments he broke, not God's commandments. Whew. You didn't think I was going to say that, did you? So he said to him, "The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." There are at least three points very important points about the Sabbath that Jesus makes in this very brief but very powerful statement. First of all, Jesus said the Sabbath was made for all mankind, not just for Jews, but for mankind. In fact, the New Revised Standard, one of the more modern translations, renders it this way. Then he said to them, the Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath. And of course, the second meaning is that the Sabbath was made for our good, not to be our God. Because frankly, some people put the Sabbath so high on a pedestal, it became their God that they served. And God never intended for it to be that way. He intended it to be a blessing. He intended it to be a gift. In fact, Exodus 16:29, I do have one verse in that chapter. God said, they must realize that the Sabbath is the Lord's gift to you. You know, it wasn't a gift with a big book with all the do's and don'ts. That's not the kind of gift that God intended it to be. He intended it to be a gift. I hope we all think about the Sabbath as God's gift, to be able to rejoice, to be able to say, stop the world and let me off. There's a song about that. I'm tired of going round and round, you know. Boy, is that ever true in this day and age. So the New Living Translation renders verse 27 this way. Then Jesus said to him, the Sabbath was made to meet the needs of people, not people to meet the requirements of the Sabbath. See, because that's legalistic. If you think, well, I got to do this, 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 and this. It's like the difference between Mary and Martha, you know. Mary looked at the foundation. Martha was all about all these details. I got to do this. Why don't you help Mary? Come help me. I'm trying to clean the house. And she says, Martha, calm down. You need to listen to what I have to say. Don't worry about that dust. It'll still be there after I leave. You can clean it up then, you know. So the Sabbath is meant to be something that is for our benefit, to meet our needs. We all need to rest, you know. Even young people do. We all do. And God gives us that. Even Expositor's Bible Commentary says this about the Sabbath. Never cease to be amazed at that commentary. They come up with some pretty good stuff. It says to Jesus, the Sabbath was not created for its own sake. It was a gift of God to man. Its purpose was not to put man in a kind of a straitjacket. It was for his good, to provide rest from labor and opportunity for worship. You can't say it any better than that, can you? New Testament, Jesus Christ. There it is. So this, I'll share you a couple of quotes from a couple of books from traditional Judaism today. So I guess there's been some learning over the years there, with even in that area. This is from a book titled The Jewish Way, Living the Holidays by Rabbi Irving Greenberg. He says, the Sabbath and holy days are the key periods of individual and family renewal. By lifting the individual out of the routine that controls and often deadens daily life. A book titled What is a Jew? By Rabbi Morris Kurtzer. He says this, Shabbat is a time for spiritual refreshment and for a break in the routine of daily labor. It's a reminder that the need for making a living must not blind us to the need for living. I like those. You know, that tells us a lot. I think that expresses exactly what God had in mind in giving us the Sabbath. So the first point is that Jesus said the Sabbath was for all mankind. Secondly, the Sabbath is made for our good, not to be our God. And the third point is Jesus Christ is, quote unquote, Lord of the Sabbath. What does that mean? That means that he is the authority on how to keep the Sabbath, not Jewish tradition. So he came to set the record straight. You've heard it was said, here's what I tell you. He's the authority. He's the one that determines how it should be kept. Once again, Expositor's Bible Commentary, spot on. Since the Sabbath was made for man, it says, he who is man's Lord has authority to determine its law and use. Very good. Agree 100%. All right, so that's an overview of the Sabbath and the time it was created down through the Old Testament into the New Testament. So what about the future of the Sabbath? Is there any future for it? Well, yes, there is. We all know that, don't we? Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, we've heard quoted here already, one of the main scriptures about the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. Very important point in here about the Sabbath, even though the word Sabbath is not mentioned. Isaiah chapter 2, beginning verse 2. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. What we used to call a teachable attitude back in the old days. Notice then what it goes on to say, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. The law of God is going to be taught from Jerusalem. Guess what is in the law of God? We all know, don't we? Fourth commandment, keep the Sabbath. So the Sabbath obviously will be taught and observed during the millennium. Another famous scripture, Isaiah 66, verse 23. Isaiah 66, verse 23. It shall come to pass that from one new moon to another and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me. And that is not necessarily to equate the new moon with the Sabbath. I mean, the Sabbath is obviously one of the commandments, very clear instruction on how to keep the Sabbath. Obviously, the new moons were observed in Old Testament times. That can't be denied. And it appears they'll be observed during the millennium as well. But it's not on the same par with the Sabbath. In fact, functionally speaking, the new moons served a very practical purpose back in the old days, you know, the time of Old Testament Israel. I think sometimes we tend to forget how different the Old Testament world was, or even New Testament world, to the world today. The new moons were people's timekeeping methods to know when was a new moon. I know you can look up in the sky and see it and everything, but I don't know about you, but I could pick on any one of two, three, four nights where it looks like a new moon to me. Maybe I need glasses, I don't know. But you know, in Old Testament Israel, basically the priests determined when the new moon was, and they blew a trumpet. And everybody said, okay, it's a new moon today. My hometown, we had a factory there that had a lot of people working there. And when it came noon, they had a whistle. You could hear it all over town. Okay, time to quit work. They could have said, well, okay, work until noon. One person's watch would say one thing, another person's watch would say another thing. So served a very, very functional purpose. And obviously, any type of happy occasion can be celebrated. Nothing wrong with celebrating something that's happy, whether it's a, you know, whatever it might be. But the New Living Translation puts this in a little bit different way, and whether this is correct or not, I think it certainly is correct, whether it's the main intention or not, I don't know. But actually, New English Translation, it says from one month to the next and from one Sabbath to the next, all people come to worship me. So they take it as me referring to the fact that people are going to worship God from month to month, from week to week. And we don't have to, you know, I mean, we know it's going to be on the Sabbath. That's very, very clear. But it could be just simply saying it's going to happen, you know, all the time from 1 week to the next, 1 month to the next. You know, the Indians, or at least they do this in TV and Western movies. I don't know if they did it that way or not. They talk about the moon, you know, it's a month. We use the word month, they use the word moon. So it's kind of served a functional purpose in that way. Well, that's another whole subject. I don't want to digress onto that. But the point is the Sabbath is still going to be kept, obviously, during the millennium. We all know that. But speaking of the millennium, here's something that's very, very important as well. And that's why I was saying it's an appropriate topic to consider today during the Feast of Tabernacles. And that is that both the Sabbath and the millennium are times of rest and rejoicing. So the Sabbath is actually a type of the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. In other words, the 7 day week is a type of, and we've taught this for years, you know, it's a, if God has a plan, part of which is 7,000 years long. It's not his whole plan, because 7,000 years is very short compared to eternity, which you can't compare it to because, you know, it's endless. But there's an obvious pattern there between the 6 work days and day of rest versus 6 days of man's rule and 1,000 years of the rule of Jesus Christ. And we're not the only ones that believe that, and we didn't come up with it originally either. Actually, this comes out of Jewish tradition. Jewish tradition has long considered the Messianic age as, quote, the day that shall be all Sabbath and rest in the life everlasting. If you're familiar with the Talmud, which I'm not, it's Tamid, T-A-M-I-D, 7:4. So that is the exact quote. The day that shall be all Sabbath and rest in life everlasting. Edward Gibbon, you've all heard of his book written in 1776 titled The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, right? We've heard about that many, many years ago, documented the facts regarding first century Christians. He says, quote, "The ancient and popular doctrine of the millennium was intimately connected with the second coming of Christ. As the works of the creation had been finished in 6 days, their duration in their present state, according to a tradition which was attributed to the prophet Elijah, was fixed to 6,000 years. By the same analogy, it was inferred that this long period of labor and contention, which had now almost elapsed, would be succeeded by a joyful Sabbath of 1,000 years, and that Christ, with the triumphant band of the saints and elect who had escaped death or had been miraculously revived, would reign upon earth till the time appointed for the last and general resurrection." Well, there's a lot of truth in that. Out of all things, Edward Gibbon, a lot of that's been lost over the years, even in Christianity. But there it was. The 11th edition Encyclopedia Britannica, in an article titled Millennium. Very informative as well. I'll just share a brief quote from that. It explains, quote, "The Messianic kingdom will last for 1,000 years. In 6 days, God created the world. On the seventh, he rested. But a day of God is equal to 1,000 years, Psalm 90, verse 4. Hence, the world will last for 6,000 years of toil and labor, and then will come 1,000 years of Sabbath rest for the people of God in the kingdom of the Messiah." And he went on to say, this idea must have already been very common in the first century before Christ. This is a very well-known tradition and understanding. From the last and maybe least, as far as authority is concerned, Wikipedia, you know, it always comes up first when you Google something online. I mean, it's good, but it's, you know, anyway, for what it's worth, I think it's on target what they say. It says the belief that the seventh millennium will correspond to the Messianic age is founded upon a universalized application of the concept of Shabbat, the seventh day of the week. This tradition maintains that each day of the week corresponds to 1,000 years of creation, just as the 6 days of the work week culminate in the sanctified seventh day of Shabbat. So too will the sixth millennia of creation culminate in the sanctified seventh millennium. Hebrew years 6,000, 7,000, that is the Messianic age. Just as Shabbat is the sanctified day of rest and peace, a time representing joyful salvation, or satisfaction rather, with the labors completed within the previous 6 days, so too the seventh millennium will correspond to a universal day of rest and peace, a time of completeness of the work performed in the six previous millennia. You know, we've heard already a lot of the prophecies about what we often used to call the world tomorrow will be like, the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. Isaiah chapter 14, I don't think we've read this one yet. Isaiah chapter 14, I'll read this once again in the New Living Translation. I don't know if it's sermons on the right or on the left or with the glass. Isaiah 14, beginning verse 3. "In that wonderful day when the Lord gives his people rest from sorrow and fear, from slavery and chains, you will taunt the king of Babylon. You will say, quote, 'The mighty man has been destroyed. Yes, your insolence is ended. For the Lord has crushed your wicked power and broken your evil rule. You struck the people with endless blows of rage and held the nations in your angry grip with unrelenting tyranny. But finally, the earth is at rest and quiet, and now it can sing again.'" A very poetic time of rest from sorrow and problems and suffering, and a time of rejoicing where people can sing again. How many times do you hear people singing nowadays, whistling while they work? There was even a song decades ago, "Whistle While You Work." You don't hear it anymore because people aren't happy. People will be able to be happy again. Does that sound familiar? That's why we're here at the Feast of Tabernacles, right? To enjoy a foretaste of that time. And what is the main commandment, instruction regarding how to keep the feast? You can find it in several places. We'll just look at Deuteronomy 16, if you would. Deuteronomy 16. Of course, the instructions are given to the nation of Israel, and we have to kind of glean the principle from it and how we apply it. But it's pretty obvious what the main point here is. Verse 13 of Deuteronomy 16, "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days when you've gathered from your threshing floor and your wine press. I doubt that many, if any of you in here, have a threshing floor. Probably some of you have wine presses, but maybe not a threshing floor. But it was at the end of the harvest. We all know that. And notice verse 14, and you shall rejoice in your feast. Not just you, but you and your son and your daughter. It's a family feast, like we've emphasized all the way through. Your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates. So this is, it should be a time for rejoicing for everybody. I'm going to share something. I don't think this family would mind. One of the kids asked their parents, what if you make $200,000 a year? How could you spend that much money at the feast? Your tithe would be $20,000. And, of course, they knew the answer, and I mentioned to them as well, you know, it says here, don't neglect the people who don't have a $200,000 a year income. There are people who are needy. And people on assistance, it's just bare bones, you know. It's to have everybody rejoice and have a good time. The whole family, not only your immediate family, but the whole church family. And make sure that nobody goes without. That's what God has in mind. But the key word here, rejoice. Because it pictures a time, a happy time, when the earth will be singing again. They won't have all these horrible things going on. When the worldwide war is over and done and dream of peace comes true, you know, the last version of Rainbow Stew. I don't think we'll find out how to burn water, but, you know, some of the things in that song. But still, it's a time of great rejoicing. Going on, it says, verse 15, 7 days, you shall keep a sacred feast of the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses. Because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and all the work of your hands, so that you may surely rejoice. There's the word again. One more time, down to verses 14 and 15. This festival will be a happy time. This is New Living Translation. This festival will be a happy time of celebrating with your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, the Levites, foreigners, orphans, and widows from your towns. For 7 days you must celebrate this festival to honor the Lord your God at the place he chooses. For it's he who blesses you with bountiful harvest and gives you success in all your work. This festival will be a time of great joy for all. That sounds a little familiar. Doesn't it sound kind of like the Sabbath? The Sabbath is supposed to be a time to rejoice and be happy and to do something different from the world and get out of the world as best you can and take that time to rest and draw close to God. So what I'm getting at here is that the Sabbath, in a sense, is like a mini Feast of Tabernacles. Because same concept is to be emphasized. Rejoice and enjoy the Sabbath. And realize it's a special time. It's different than the rest of the week. The Feast of Tabernacles is to teach us that the coming millennial rule of Jesus Christ will result in a way of life that is different, very different from the world we live in today. So since the Sabbath is like a mini feast, and the Feast of Tabernacles pictures the millennium, and the Sabbath pictures the millennium, all three of these they fit together. They all celebrate the same thing. Very, very important to realize that. God really wants us to understand. Well, there's more to the story that connects the Sabbath with the feast. At this point, we need to put the weekly Sabbath on the shelf temporarily in sermon here. And consider another meaning of the word rest that's introduced to the nation of Israel in Deuteronomy 3 and verse 20, if you turn over there. Because we think of rest as just resting from work. But there's another concept in the Bible that's very, very important about rest as well. And I think you'll see it very clearly when we read these scriptures. Deuteronomy 3, starting in verse 18. Then I commanded you at that time, saying, the Lord your God has given you this land to possess, speaking of the land of Canaan. All you men of valor shall cross over armed before your brethren, the children of Israel. Verse 19, but your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall stay in your cities which I have given you until the Lord has given rest to your brethren as to you. And they also possess the land which the Lord your God is giving them beyond the Jordan. Then each of you may return to his possession, which I have given to you. So this was told to the nation of Israel, saying, well, you know, I'm giving you the land of Canaan, but, you know, it's got to be conquered first. So you families stay where you are on this other side of the Jordan here. And the armies, the men of valor, can go over there and take care of the opposition and make it safe so that the rest of you can come over there. So you have that rest is what he's referring to there. You know, you have these songs about when I cross over the river and the river of Jordan and the promised land. You know why? Because that's the type of the millennium. The Israelites going into land of Canaan is a type of us entering into the millennial rest. Okay? We can make that more specific if you move ahead to Deuteronomy 12 and verse 10, which makes that very clearly what he means by the word rest. Rest from what? It tells us right here. We don't have to figure it out. We can go right to the book. It's like we heard the other day. Verse 10, Deuteronomy 12, when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from your enemies around about so that you may dwell in safety. So Deuteronomy 12:10 identifies this as rest from your enemies in the promised land across the Jordan. All of the first generation, as we know, was denied access to the new land except for Caleb and Joshua. It was the second generation under Joshua that were given the promised land and rest from their enemies. So it was that generation under Joshua that crossed the Jordan River and entered the land under Joshua's leadership again. So let's see what Joshua has to say about that rest. Joshua chapter 21. We'll read verses 43 through 45. Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45. Kind of a summary here. He says, so the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers. And they took possession of it and dwelt in it. Verse 44, the Lord gave them rest all around according to all he had sworn to their fathers. And not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into the land. And we would call it a time of peace. That's fine. But God calls it a time of rest. Rest from their enemies. Verse 45, not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. So that's the end of that promise of rest, right? Wrong. No, it's not. We now move ahead to the time of David. Psalm 95, starting verse 6. Psalm 95, starting in verse 6. David writes, O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture. Now, while you're still turning, sorry, bear in mind, this is quite a bit later, past the period of the judges, certainly past the time of Joshua. I mean, you see that in your Bible, Joshua, Judges, and so forth, and the kings, and so forth. David was actually, not the first king, Saul was. So it's quite a bit later, after the second generation had already settled in the land, and God said, I've done everything I promised to do. Okay, he did, but didn't last. They enjoyed a period of peace and rest for a while, but didn't last. So David is saying here, going on, he's our God, we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness. When your fathers, that would have been the first generation out of Egypt, tested me, they tried me, though they saw my work. For 40 years I was grieved with that generation and said, it's a people who go astray in their hearts and they don't know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. So as we know the story, every person in that first generation, except for Caleb and Joshua, died in the wilderness. It was the second generation that were promised that rest. Psalm 95 is widely acknowledged as a Sabbath psalm. It explains that the Israelites of the first generation out of Egypt failed to enter God's rest because of the hardness of their hearts. That brings us to the book of Hebrews. Now, I don't have time to go through all the verses here. I'm thinking that would be a good Bible study maybe for a future feast. It really goes into great detail about this concept of rest and how it applies to the Sabbath and how it applies to the Feast of Tabernacles even. Well, we'll just skip down to verse 6 through 8 in Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4, starting in verse 6. Picking kind of up where Psalm 95 leaves off, because as you may know, Psalm 95 is quoted in Hebrews 3 and Hebrews 4. So in Hebrews 4, starting in verse 6, since therefore it remains that some must enter it, that would be that rest. And those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, which would have been the first generation. Again, he designates a certain day, saying in David, Psalm 95, which we just read, today, after such a long time as it's been said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Now, notice verse 8. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. Oh, well, I thought, didn't we read it said God fulfilled all of his promises? Well, he did. But you see, that rest was not totally complete. It wasn't forever. It was temporary. And the writer of Hebrews is saying, you know, the fact that David's still talking about a time of rest, well, that must mean that it wasn't totally fulfilled under Joshua. There must be some other rest that he's referring to here. What do you suppose that could be? Well, again, once again, we don't have to guess because the Bible tells us the answer. So verse 9 says, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God. Now, you probably know this. You probably heard this explained before, that this word rest in verse 9 is different from every other word in the entire Bible. It's the only place it's found in the whole Bible. The other Greek word is preposition K-A-T-A and P-A-U-S-I-N. And it's talking about a time of pausing. This one here is sabbatismos. Obvious. It's relating to the Sabbath. Okay? There remains, therefore, and one translation, New Revised, says, so then a Sabbath rest still remains for the people of God. It's the only New Testament, only, of course, biblical occurrence, since the New Testament was written in Greek, the Old Testament wasn't, except for the Septuagint, of course. Its meaning is fundamental, I think, to understanding its pivotal verse, which is a conclusion of everything that was said previously in chapter 3 and chapter 4 about entering into this rest. Well, for one thing, and of course, we obviously know, since it's sabbatismos, and the New Revised Standard renders it that way, a Sabbath rest remains for people of God. You think, well, the Sabbath is still valid today. And that's true. It is. And this verse says that. But there's also another meaning to this that's probably even the fundamental meaning. And this is why I think Paul wrote Hebrews. Nobody knows that. But Paul was so clever in how he could weave these different ideas together. And there's, you know, some people can do this thing and it's impressive, but other people think, wow, Peter said, man, I don't get some of his stuff. You know, it's so complicated. That's why I said I'd like to, maybe I or somebody cover Hebrews 3 and 4 in the future to go through verse by verse. But the other aspect, if you look at the context, talking about entering a rest, is the fact that, you know, there is still a need to have rest from our enemies. Do we have rest from our enemies today? No, we don't. There's a lot of enemies still out there, right? So it wasn't totally fulfilled under the time of Joshua. One of the things that the JFB commentary, I don't quote that a lot, it's a very old one, but still good, you know. I guess I could pull a Yogi Bear and say it's good where it's good. But anyway, he says, Israel under Joshua enjoyed at last rest from war in Canaan. But the rest in this verse 9 is a nobler and more exalted Sabbath rest. Literally cessation or rest from weariness, sorrow, and sin, and rest in the completion of God's new creation. But he goes on to say, even if that's the meaning, he says, but this verse indirectly establishes the obligation of the Sabbath still, for the type continues until the antitype supersedes it. So what he's saying is, well, this rest is talking about actually the millennial rest and even a greater time of rest beyond that. You probably know what we're talking about. We'll get to that here in a moment as well. But he's saying, since the Sabbath is a type of that, you know, I mean, it's still in effect. Of course, we know the Sabbath and some of the fundamental laws of God, spiritual laws of God, are always going to be in effect. But he's saying this complete rest promise hasn't been fulfilled yet. So every time we meet together in the Sabbath, we're looking forward to the time of rest that'll be extant during the millennium, right? It's a weekly reminder of that. And the feast is an annual reminder of that time of rest. Rest from our enemies. You know, a lot of your enemies, you leave back home when you come to the feast. Of course, some come with you. And my dad used to say a skunk takes its stink wherever it goes. Certain problems you can't leave home, but an awful lot of them you can. I don't even like to watch television at the feast. I like to say, I just want to be away from the world. I mean, you tune in the news and it's the latest rape, the latest robbery. Remember that song about "We Sure Need a Little Good News Today" by Anne Murray? You know, the newspapers, everything, this is full of bad news. I just want to get away from that and just say, stop the world, let me off. I want a bit of rest from this. The bad news is we got to go back to it again. So I tell people about going to Hawaii. It's the only bad thing about it is you got to come back home, which is not a problem here in Central Oregon because it's a nice place to come back to. But anyway, so there's this two meanings of that verse. Which one is intended? I don't know, but I think both of them are. You don't have to pick between one and the other because they're both true. The Sabbath is a type of the millennial rest. That's why it's called a different word, because I think what the author of Hebrews is saying, this is not just your normal everyday rest. This is a much nobler rest, much more complete rest. So he used the word sabbatismus. Some Bible scholars think Paul actually invented the word. And I don't know if that's true or not, because I never asked Paul, didn't have the opportunity. Someday we will. But anyway, he wanted to accentuate the fact that this period of rest is way better than what was experienced in the time of Joshua. It's kind of like peace, you know. The world's definition of peace is nobody shooting at somebody else. Well, God has a lot better definition of peace than that, right? It's a complete peace. We can just relax and be happy and not worry about anything. So observance of the weekly Sabbath remains a vital part of New Covenant worship of God because it reminds us of God's promise of future rest. All right, and so what is this ultimate rest that Hebrews 4:9 is referring to? You know, the deeper meaning of Jesus Christ's dramatic statement about rest that we read in Matthew 11:28, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest." In contrast to the heavy religious burdens imposed by the scribes and Pharisees. Along with that, ultimately, he promises us total rest from all of our enemies. His promise is to be released from the bondage of sin. John 8:32-36 talk about that. Because you've heard it said, you know, during, I think it was Mr. Ime's sermon, we have these three enemies, Satan, society, and self, you know. So we still have to struggle with enemies today. But there's going to come a time we don't have to struggle with those enemies anymore. It's not here yet, obviously. I think we all know that. But John chapter 8 and verse 32. "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And, of course, the hackle stood up in the back and said, "What do you mean free? We never been in bondage to anybody." I had a short memory, I guess, because they certainly were. But he's not talking about freedom in the standpoint of not being a captive nation. He's talking about a greater form of freedom. Jesus said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin." And this tense of the verb here is talking about whoever practices sin is a slave to sin. A lot of us know what that's like. We've had habits in the past that are very, very hard to overcome, addictions and things like that, you know, that things that are very, very difficult. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Let me clarify. I didn't mean to imply that an addiction is necessarily a sin, but it does certainly lead to sin, you know. But anyway, the point is that he's talking about a type of freedom that's greater than just simply political freedom. "Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." So he's talking about a greater type of freedom, a rest from all of our enemies. Romans 8 and verse 2, another passage here, talks about freedom. Romans 8 and verse 2. "The law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus had made me free from the law of sin and death." That cycle of sin that leads to death. We all sin. But we've been freed from the bondage of sin because Jesus Christ paid that death penalty. It's not hanging over our heads anymore. Satan is not able to pull out that trump card against us because we have a bigger trump card, sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So it says in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 through 16, that Jesus actually overcame and the power of Satan over us, the power and the fear of death. That's the beginning aspect of the freedom that God offers to us. Freedom from worry, freedom from fear of punishment, so long as we hang in there and go God's way in that direction, however imperfectly. Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 14 through 16. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, so that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. The word destroy means to deprive him of his power. It didn't mean to put him out of existence. That's not what the word means here. And release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. We've been delivered from that. You don't have to be afraid anymore. God loves you. He's willing to forgive you as long as you're willing to go his way. Satan is the one that tries to create fear. And Jesus offers us freedom from death, freedom from fear, freedom from the consequences of sin. Well, but like I said, we're still not totally free from sin, right? In 1 John 1, it says, if we say we have no sin, we're kidding ourselves. The truth isn't in us. We all need the grace of God. And we have that available to us. So we're not totally free from sin because we're still physical. We're still subject to human nature. And as one book title suggests, Satan is still alive and well on planet Earth. So all three of those enemies are still there. So we don't have complete rest, do we? Started, but it's not there yet. The millennium will be a time of much greater rest from enemies, since the chief enemy of mankind, Satan the devil, will have been put away for the 1,000 years and won't have access to deceive the nations during that period of time. But again, like Mr. Rimes brought out, that doesn't mean to say that people are going to be walking on air and have halos over their heads. They're still going to have to struggle with things they've been taught. I don't want to rehash the sermon, but it's a very good point. Still not going to be total rest. As long as we're physical, there's always going to be that temptation to sin. So the story of rest has to continue. Psalm 110, verses 1 and 2. Another one of the Psalms of David. This is a messianic psalm. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Who's that talking about? It's talking about Jesus Christ. That's quoted in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 12 through 13. Let's go there now. Hebrews 10, verses 12 and 13. But this man, speaking of Jesus Christ, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. From that time, waiting until his enemies are made his footstool. When would you say that we will have complete and total eternal rest from all of our enemies? Will that happen in this life? No. Will it happen in the millennium? No. It's going to be better in the millennium with Satan not around, a whole lot better. Well, again, let's see what the Bible says. 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I'm going to read verses 20 through 26. Resurrection chapter, we've often referred to this as. But now Christ is risen from the dead, and verse 20, has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all should be made alive. But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits. A lot of holy day themes in here. And afterward, those who are Christ's at his coming. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, when he puts an end to all rule and all authority and power. For he must reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet, just as we read in Psalm 110 and Hebrews chapter 10. And notice what it says. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Every one of us in this room still has that as an enemy. Some of you have lost loved ones this past year. We don't have rest from that enemy yet. That's the final enemy that's going to be destroyed. So, to put it succinctly, complete rest from all of our enemies will not take place until the time that death is destroyed, the time of the new heavens and new earth. my favorite scripture in the entire Bible because it's so moving and it's so incredible and it's so poetically graphic is Revelation 21. Revelation 21, verse 5. I'll back up to verse 1. As we know, Revelation 21 and 22 are talking about the new heavens and new earth. And it's kind of like these touchy-feely movies, you know. I love to watch those because they always have a happy ending. You know, it used to be in the old days, every story started out once upon a time, and everyone ended, they live happily ever after. Somebody said about Midnight Cowboy, said that's the first time that the thing began when the guy rode off into the sunset. But anyway, you know, happy endings, the ultimate of happy endings. What I was going to say was that kind of frustrating when you watch those movies because, okay, let me throw out an example. And if you think it's a bad movie, forgive me, but Sleepless in Seattle is one. You're waiting a whole time for them to get together, and they finally get together, and then they roll the credits, and the movie's over. You get a chance to see them, watch them, live happily ever after. We got to correct that in the world tomorrow, you know, and show some happily ever after stuff, you know. But God did the same thing. He tells us all these problems in the world, and he gives us two chapters and said we're going to live happily ever after. You wish he could have added to that and told us a little bit more about what happy ever after is about. But I think he figured, if this doesn't get you, I can't tell you anymore. This is enough. Verse 1, now I saw a new heaven and new earth, for the first heaven and first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the new holy city, the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And this is, I love this verse, verse 4 and 5. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. How more touching can you get than that? We all have shed tears. The only tears he's not going to wipe away is going to be the tears of joy. Those will be flowing in abundance, I guarantee you. And we see those people that we've lost as loved ones. There won't be any more death or sorrow or crying. Can you imagine that? There will be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. And this is not some pie-in-the-sky idea. It's going to happen. God said so. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. They're going to happen. God's Sabbath is a wonderful gift to his people. But not only does it offer us physical and spiritual benefits in this life, it's also rich with important symbolic meaning for our ultimate destiny and the ultimate goal of this phase of God's plan. And that is complete and total rest from all of our enemies and the eternal peace and joy of the new heavens and new earth described in the final chapters of the Bible. We've got a lot of enemies, folks. When this feast is over, we're going back into a world that has a lot of problems. I just want to encourage you to think about this time, that God wants us to be all together. We all have things that are we have to deal with in our life. But this God's church is a family. Families stay together. They love each other. They work things out. They have differences, but that's okay. They accept each other and love each other. You don't go somewhere else. You stick with the family. You can ask anybody who's gone through hard times. You can ask Mr. Waters. Unfortunately, he doesn't have human family here, but he has church family. What would he do without church family? Now stop and think about that. That's more important than any kind of difference we might have as far as any kind of doctrine or whatever. If it doesn't lead us to love God and love human beings better, then it's not as important as that. The Sabbath is to be a reminder of that, of what was really important. What is the main focal points? Jesus prayed that ultimately we all become one as he and the Father are one. And enjoy that total rest and peace from all of our enemies. We're not even close to that yet in this world. We still have to struggle with those enemies. The millennium will be a time when we can help people to enjoy a better time of peace. But the ultimate reality that we all look forward to is that time of the new heavens and new earth when God wipes away all those tears and gets rid of every enemy, including death itself. You know, Mr. Armstrong used to chuckle and say, when you read the end of the book, we win! Well, you know, the Sabbath reminds us every week of that ultimate victory over Satan and all of our enemies and the glorious experience of spiritual rest, peace, and joy as spirit beings for all eternity. So I hope you grasp that vision here at the feast. It's been a theme throughout here that God's church is family. We've talked about the wonderful conditions of the extent on earth during the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. And we need to think about the ultimate peace and joy of the new heavens, new earth as spirit beings, and all those enemies will be put away. And on the weekly Sabbath throughout the year, please remember that. Focus on that hope. Because that's what we need to do. There's so many things out in this world that threatens to divert our focus. There's so many things you can get off on the tangents on. You've got to stick, another quote, you've got to stick with the trunk of the tree. And we all know what that is. It's a four-letter word, love. That's what unites us together. And that's what we have to look forward to for all eternity when all of our enemies have finally been laid to rest. And we can enjoy eternity with God and Jesus Christ and all of God's faithful people down through the ages. I said to some here, no more than one person here at the feast, I think we need 1,000 years just to get caught up on getting acquainted with each other. So we've got a wonderful time to look forward to, and let's be sure and keep our priorities straight and let the Sabbath and feast remind us of these wonderful promises that lie ahead and the great time of rest that God is offering to us.